Conference is being recorded.
So welcome everybody to, this is our second of four conference calls for RM103, which is Understand Legal Risk. Just to reassure you, there's not as many required learning activities as there are conference calls. So, and one of the conference calls is a required learning activity, so hopefully that makes it a little bit easier. I'd like to acknowledge that today I'm hosting the call from the traditional territory of the Kwamundam First Nation and Tonkwatin Council. Last week, for those of you who joined us and those of you who participated, if you haven't had a chance yet to look through last week, be sure to go through it because it will catch you up to where we are this week. We became more familiar with some of the terminology around legal risk, and we also talked about four factors or issues that are used to determine negligence. So those were really important to understand, and last week's RLA or required learning activity was built around two of those issues. So this week we're sticking with the number four, and we're going to look at four types of liability that determine who is responsible for negligence. And then towards the end of the call, I'll make sure that I go through what our second required learning activity is. It's not due this week. It's not due till the end of the following week. And then it will lead into our last conference call. So it's kind of a combination. So it's great that you guys are on the call today. That means you get to pick what type of lawyer you want to be for the case study. So anyway, before I get into this week's content, though, let's just do a really quick round of introduction. So who you are, where you're calling from, and if you would like to share one concept about legal risk that you find has been important to learn about as a recreation leader. So I'll pop that into the chat. And you don't have to answer the last question. If it's not, you know, fresh in your mind which concept is really important, don't worry about it. Just introduce yourself and where you're calling from. So again, who you are, where you're calling from, and one legal risk concept that you've learned more about if you want to. So Justine, let's start with you first because I just have it written down in that order. So we'll go from me to you.
Can I actually skip because I haven't been able to read upon this just yet?
Yeah, so maybe just share with everybody where, you know, well, I guess I already told everybody. Where are you calling from and why? Why are you being so busy? 9 weeks of containment is a lot. So for sure, we totally get it. Thanks. And thanks for joining us today.
Oh, yeah. No. Okay, I'm just going to introduce myself.
Perfect.
My name is Justine Barrison. I am from Deshiko in the BT. Right now at the moment, I am an executive assistant for client services in Cleto Governance. And I have past experience with recreation for the past 10 years. I was a coordinator, however, that changed the plans just due to mental health and whatnot. But what makes this important to me is in the role of a recreation leader is, well, legal risk concept. I would say, I can't think of a thing right now, but I will get back to that.
Yeah, no worries. That's okay. It was just a sort of, what you can do is just listen to what everybody else shares, and then that might trigger a few things. I probably shouldn't have put you on the spot right off the bat. Thanks for joining us today. Let's go to Kelsey and then Meg and then Tim.
I'm Kelsey. I'm the active living coordinator for ARPAN, so I'm calling from Whitehorse. One legal risk concept that I've learned about is the difference between duty of care and standard of care, and that's important to me because we deal a lot with small contracts for recreation across the Yukon. So it's important to understand the difference and where we lie in both of those.
Awesome. Thanks, Kelsey. And I really appreciate your post. I think Tim had some good feedback for you, too, that it was nice and concise and you explained it really clearly. So thanks for sharing that. Over to you, Megan.
Hi, I'm Megan Lenny. I'm calling from Aklavik North Territory in the Nisku'awit Settlement Region. I am the land-based coordinator for a few different organizations. My main base is Western Arctic Youth Collective. With legal risk, I studied it quite a few times. I feel like my head can't fully wrap around the whole idea of legal risk. I guess like the biggest thing I learned this week is how, or something that I found really interesting was how liability can be established. In the first RLA, I feel like I could have did a lot more detail. Anyway, I found it really interesting how, I feel like this is my Monday today. My brain is not working at all.
That's okay. You probably have a day off tomorrow, so Friday's going to feel like Monday, too.
Yeah, it'll be nice to have a few days off, to be honest.
Well, thanks, Megan. And I really like how you pull out the, you know, establishing liability, because I think that, and also reiterating that this is something that you studied a lot and it's still, it's hard to wrap your head around. And this is probably my fifth or sixth time teaching this one, and I helped create it, and I still have to wrap my head around it. So I don't know if it's just not intuitive for us, like I think looking for risk and managing risk is, but the legal risk is something that, unless we're a lawyer, we probably don't understand as much. So no worries, but thank you for sharing that. And over to you, Kim. I see that you're in the chat, so you should be able to see my questions. Just to introduce yourself and one concept that you feel has sort of, you've learned more about or that it, and is important to you in your role.
Sure. I'm Kim Van Dam. I'm at Sumitay Yellowknife. I am the I'm the Professional Development Director at the NWC Record Parks Association. And Megan, I want to talk to you before you get off the call just for like 10 seconds. Don't hang up too quickly when we're all done today. One of the concepts of legal risk that I think is really important, not just for me in my line of work, but I think probably for most of us here, is the concept of vicarious liability, mostly because we are probably involved with organizations who are either funding or offering some sort of recreation activity or program, or sponsoring one, that where our organizations could be at risk based on what happens with the people who we hire or the program as it operates. So vicarious liability is something that I think a lot about, and I think it's important for everybody here in this group to think about, especially.
Thanks, Tim. That's great. And you actually, all of you touched on things that I'm going to go through again on a conference call, because you touched on the things that are really important to understand. So I always figure that it doesn't hurt to reiterate or bring up other examples or think through it. And the RLA that we'll be talking about at the end is a case study, and it gives you an opportunity to apply your understanding of these different concepts. That's really what we're looking for is thinking through them and how does this work. So I'm just going to go through a little bit of content, and then I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, mostly related to you and your position and what what this means to you. So, and I will pause as often as possible for questions from you. And if you have any, please just pop them in the chat. So, as Kelsey mentioned last week, our RLA encouraged you to apply the concepts of duty of care and standard of care. I just want to, I found a slightly different wording around them, and I just wanted to point out something that I might not have stressed enough last week. So, yeah?
Sorry, I should have been on mute. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay. No worries. Is that kids? Okay, so I just want to look once more quickly at duty of care and standard of care and how it applies to you. And the one thing I think I need to stress a little bit more is that a duty of care arises because there's a relationship between two parties. So the relationship could be you provide a program and somebody registers in your program. That's a relationship. Somebody signs up to play volleyball. They have a relationship with the person who's coaching it. You go to a fitness class. You perhaps pay or fill out a waiver or something. That establishes a relationship with the fitness instructor. Also possibly with the organization where that class is being held. So in recreation, we establish those relationships all the time. As Tim mentioned and as Kelsey mentioned, they're not just relationships that you have with somebody who's using your direct program, but they could be because you're providing a program that somebody else, or you're providing funding that somebody else uses to provide a program. So the relationship there is a little bit more convoluted, but I think it's really important to recognize that duty of care exists when there's that type of relationship. So when the relationship is evident, your duty is to foresee and prevent injuries or damages. So foresee what could happen and make sure it doesn't. So Kelsey, I think you shared that you use criminal record checks. So you're thinking, okay, if we're giving somebody money to run a program in a community, we're going to collect a criminal record check, and that makes, you know, that's preventing something that could possibly go wrong. So there's a lot in that, but that was a really good example that you shared, Kelsey. Megan, you posted housekeeping rules, and I really like that too. I might be not recalling correctly, but you know, I was imagining whether it's on the land in a camp or in a facility, having sort of those housekeeping rules that provide guidance and raise awareness of that. So those sorts of things definitely show or demonstrate your duty of care. They also reduce risk too. So the other thing to remember is, or to recognize, is that there is no standard of care unless there's a duty of care. So that's why we talked about duty of care first, and that's why courts look at duty of care first. And then they will establish standard of care if you answer yes, there was a duty of care. So if someone gets hurt, but there's no relationship with that person, like you're both participating side by side in the same program, you don't have a duty of care, and then they don't look at standard of care. So that is why usually the courts actually look at the standard of care as the last or fourth thing when they're determining negligence. So hopefully that kind of explains that it's based on a relationship, and that, you know, I can think of lots of different relationships that we establish with recreation. So whether we're volunteering or whether we're paid in recreation, on the land programs, in our communities, pretty much you can assume there's always a duty of care because we're in that role. Are there any questions, and just speak up, are there any other questions about duty of care or standard of care before I move on to this week's content? Okay, awesome. If you do have questions, just pop them in the chat. So if I assume that all four conditions are satisfied before that to establish negligence, and we've said yes, there is negligence, the next question or the next thing that the courts look at is liability. So if negligence is about the type of conduct or behavior, liability is about who is responsible for what happened as a result of the negligent behavior. So that's a bit to wrap your head around, but basically think of, you know, negligence is the behavior, and liability is who has responsibility for what happened. So hopefully that makes sense. So just if you guys want, I can even pop that in the chat if you need me to. The interesting part here, and Tim mentioned vicarious liability, and Megan, you mentioned establishing liability. The really interesting part is that responsibility or liability is not always assigned to the person who found it negligent. So on slide 22, if you happen to have the slides in front of you, and if you don't, no worries, I'll just explain that. Slide 22 shows that there's four common types of liability that determine responsibility. And these are personal, vicarious, as Tim mentioned, occupiers, and products. And these are four that are really important to us in our field of work. they're used to determine who's responsible for the negligence. And as I just mentioned, it's important to note that in a lawsuit, it's not necessarily the person whose negligent behavior that's responsible. And a judge, too, can assign more than one type of liability or responsibility. So if you think of the four on the slide, it doesn't all have to fit into one of those boxes when the judge decides on a court case. It can be split among a couple. And I'll give you a couple of examples about that. So let me just start with personal liability, and I'll give you an example, and then I'll give you an example of vicarious liability, and then I'll stop to see if you have any questions. So slide 23 describes a little bit about personal liability, and this one the courts always look at first. So what they're trying to look at is, if an individual is negligent, is that individual the one that they're going to find personally liable or personally responsible for what has happened? Okay, so here's an example for you. So a yoga instructor will need to have personal insurance because if there's a lawsuit during which the yoga instructor is found personally liable, and if the instructor doesn't have insurance or not enough insurance, that yoga instructor might be required to pay the amount awarded if they're found to be negligent and therefore there's personal liability in a court case. That's a pretty scary thought, I think. So let's go on to the next one then, and look at moving from personal liability, okay, to vicarious liability. So once personal liability has been established, the courts then move on to ask if that person was an employee, a volunteer, or had a relationship with the organization. So if somebody's a yoga instructor and they're teaching in your facility and they have a contract to do that for you, they have a relationship with your organization. It's not as clear as if you've hired them and they're an employee, but there's still a relationship. So again, we're coming back to looking at that type of relationship. So when an employee, so for yourselves in your roles with employers, and Megan, this might be complicated if you have several different employers, when an employee acts on behalf of an employer, then they start to look at vicarious liability, which is explained on slide 24. So an employer can be responsible or vicariously liable for the actions of their employee or volunteer. But there's exceptions to that. So you may have heard the term gross negligence. So usually, unless there's gross negligence, which is often very difficult to prove in court, gross negligence would come along with probably more of an intention to actually harm. Like it's quite a different topic, and apparently it very seldom comes up in court. So usually the personal liability, then the answer is there a relationship with this person to an organization? And usually in recreation, the answer is yes. So then vicarious liability comes into effect. So I'm going to give you an example, and then I'm going to ask you if you have any questions, because this is a really big one to understand for you and your roles, and also for your organizations and your community groups and organizations. So this is a real case, example of something that happened. And it happened in Ontario. An individual from a community was injured because the ice surface in the city's arena was not thick enough. The judge found the city negligent and awarded $5 million to the plaintiff or the person who was injured. The city appealed the lawsuit because they probably didn't have $5 million. And the judge turned around and increased the decision to $7.5 million, so didn't really do much for them appealing that. Unfortunately, the city only had $5 million in liability insurance. So what they did in the lawsuit is they determined that the person or the employee responsible for the ice surface was trained and had lots of experience and should have known that the ice surface, they had the background to know that that ice surface was not safe. So the city could have turned around and sued the individual $2.5 million, like their employee. They could have sued their employee because in the court they showed that there was personal liability. That would amount, so there was personal and vicarious liability in this case determined. So you guys can probably imagine if you get slapped with a $2.5 million bill, like that's crazy. So fortunately for that employee, the city turned around and increased taxes from taxpayers to cover the remaining $2.5 million that they didn't have. So that's an interesting example of how personal liability and vicarious liability work together. So I'm just going to go around the circle and ask you if you have any questions or comments before I move on. So, Justine, any questions, comments about personal liability and vicarious liability?
Not at the moment.
Okay, thanks. Chelsea?
No, not right now.
Okay, Megan?
No.
Anson?
Yep, I sure do. So there's a couple of valuable things to note here. And the first one is that it's, I find it appalling that the city of Ottawa had only $5 million of third person liability coverage. That's ridiculous.
No, it was a small community. It wasn't Ottawa. It wasn't Ottawa.
Even for a small community. And here's why. What the standard is for almost any organization is you have to have a minimum of $2 million third person liability coverage. But on your insurance coverage. Now, the cost to up your coverage to $10 million is minimal. Like I run a small business that has $10 million of third person liability coverage. For exactly this kind of reason, because sometimes, you know, the lawsuit might exceed $2 million. Not that I ever expect to do anything that would cause it to be sued, but, you know, we're becoming a more litigious society. So for less than $50 a year, my coverage went from, and this represents like a single digit percentage point. My coverage, I feel very secure now. And the other thing I'd like to mention is that that kind of scenario, not uncommon, but also can really freak people out, especially when people think, wow, I could be held personally responsible for something that is kind of out of my control. What if I told my employer that I didn't think that the slide was safe and they still didn't close the playground down? Am I still going to be responsible? In actuality, you still might be found to be some percentage responsible. Or you might not, depends on the judge of the day. My point in this is that most organizations and municipalities that have this kind of, that have insurance and that operate programs where they have employees also have insurance that cover their employees for liability. Most people will find that in their insurance policy. So if you have employees, or if you're an employee and you think, oh my goodness, I can't take this kind of risk on, know that you are probably covered, and if you want to know for sure, then go to your employer or look at your insurance policy and find out, because or ask your agent. It's there. And I see that Carolyn has posted that that's coming up under general liability. So I'll leave it there.
Exactly. Thanks, Tim. And I think the example that I used was from probably 15, 20 years ago. So I would agree that people have upped their insurance a lot since then. I think more it was the example that, you can be personally liable, and use the example of the slide. So what that tells me, our last learning event was RM 102, which was documentation. So if you find something that's not safe, document it. Even if it's an email to somebody and says, this is not safe, can you please confirm receipt of this email? And then as an employee, you have that recorded. So if there's something that you feel isn't safe or you disagree with or something like that. So I think, more saying that we all have a responsibility, because we all have that duty of care, right? And if we follow through with, if we're maintaining a standard of care, which in that employee's case should have been to say that the ice isn't safe to skate on, it needs to be closed down. But in this case, they probably said, yes, there's a duty of care. Yes, there was damages. Yes, there was proximate cause. And yes, they didn't meet the standard of care that was set. So that's, and then that's where they started to assign this responsibility. One of the other things, sorry, go ahead.
It's Megan. If you, so with this instance, would, if you said it orally, would it hold up in court, or would you have to state that and have documentation that you stated it to your employer?
I think it would depend, right? Like, if you think that it's really an accident waiting to happen, then probably it's not bad to record it, or at least have somebody listen to you pass it on. So it doesn't come down to, you know, his word versus her word, or something like that. But I think for smaller things, you know, if you're following what the standard would be, like if the standard was, you know, the ice was 6 inches thick and it was thick enough, and maybe there was just a little crack that you didn't see and the person having to land in that crack, maybe that's different than the ice isn't thick enough and it's unsafe.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. What do you think? Like, how do you feel about that?
I just had an instance that was interesting to me. There's a few roads. Like, on the ice roads, it's stated as a government highway. But there's a few offset plowed roads that we've used to access community cabins. With that being said, I took a group of youth, and then I was I stopped and I was thinking, I wonder, like, does my insurance protect me on going to these, like, little offset roads with bringing youth? And I called my boss, and he stated that it was cover up in the sense of everything, but in court it might not hold up. So I don't know if, like, me stating that to him on the phone would suffice in court, or me sending an email would be better, stating, I contacted you, you said go ahead, kind of thing. Does that make sense?
It totally makes sense. And I mean, I think you have to think of the circumstances, right? Like, if you're out on a sat phone somewhere asking that question, there's only so much you can do, right? And, you know, even phone records would show that you made a phone call at that point in time. But as Tim's popped in the chat, you know, if you're concerned, write it down. So even just a logbook of your activities out on the land, you know, double check that, you know, so if you're, I don't know if you keep a log or an incident book or anything like that, but anything like that, just to jot it down, then that kind of covers you. But also, again, just the fact that you called and you got that reassurance, that's showing that you're doing your, you know, you're following what your standard of care is. You're something in your mind has said, there might be a potential risk here, so you've foreseen a risk. You know, what could happen? What do I need to check about? And you've gone ahead and checked. So I think in that case, it would probably mostly fall back to your employer.
Okay.
But I'm not a lawyer, so if you know any lawyers, it's better to ask them that question than me, but that would be my thinking. I don't know if anybody else has any thoughts about that, but that would, you know, I think we can only do so much. We sometimes, with risk management and with, especially with legal risk, we've gone like so far overboard. You have to think about what is really reasonable in the circumstances. And if a phone call is reasonable and you aren't able to write it down, because of where you are, then, you know, you've still done that, right?
Yeah.
So thanks for bringing that up, Megan. That's a really good example, so thank you. I think somebody also mentioned volunteers. So vicarious liability isn't just about the relationship of an employer to employees. It's also about an employer and volunteers. And so Kelsey runs a program called Real Leaders, which she explained in last week's thing. And those Real Leaders receive an honorarium through a contract for our case. So they're kind of like volunteers, but they're not really volunteers. They're a little bit removed from RK. So what our team has done is make sure that all of those individuals are covered in their general liability insurance. And to the best of my knowledge, RPA is actually the only Recompense Association out of the three territorial ones that has contractors covered under their general liability insurance. So NWTRPA and RTAM do not. So if I was a contractor working for one of those organizations, I would need to have my own professional liability insurance or my own liability insurance. Whereas if I do contracts for RPA, their general liability covers me. So it's really important to think through who's covered, like Tim pointed out, and make sure that people who might be working for you also understand. Like a volunteer might feel more at ease to understand that your general liability insurance coverage covers them in case something happens. And remember, it's not just in case something happens, it's if something happens and negligence is found. So we have to still say yes to all those four issues that go speak to negligence before we even move on to what's the responsibility, who's responsible for that negligence. So several steps here. So I think sometimes we think right away, oh my God, I'm going to get sued, I'm going to have to pay all this money, but there's all these things that have to happen first, and there's different pieces in place in Canadian law around that. So if something went to court and it was a volunteer that was perhaps found negligent, if your organization has a volunteer agreement that your volunteer has signed, then that is good, a good indication that that person is volunteering for you. Megan, in RM102, you shared a letter that you guys used with your contractors, so that establishes that relationship too. But if you don't have anything formally written down, the courts might just ask, you know, can you confirm that Susie is a volunteer with your soccer club? And, you know, if you're in court, you have to answer truthfully yes or no. So that's what it might come down to. So I just want to ask, let's see how we're, oh, actually, maybe I'll skip this question. I think we talked about it through Megan's example. My question, I'll still put it in the chat, but I want to make sure we have enough time to talk about the required learning activity. So just think through this one to yourself. Why do you need to be aware of these types of liability, and what are the implications of a lawsuit for you and your organization? So that's in regards to personal liability and vicarious liability. So something to think about, and if you have some thoughts, feel free to pop them into the chat. But so we have enough time to move on to the activity, then I will move forward here. So going on to slide 25, there's a third type of liability that's described, and this is occupier's liability. So if you own premises, you might fall underneath this one. Like if you own a building, a property, even it could be extended to if it's your private land. When it comes to public lands, it's probably a little, quite a bit more gray in that area. But with occupier's liability, the court looks to see if negligence is due to either the premises or the activity. So there's two different things here. And what that means is premises means that the owner of the facility is at fault. And then those owners are protected through their general liability. So if you own a building and ice falls off the roof and hits somebody on the head and gives them a concussion that they don't recover well from, there's probably negligence, because we all know that in the north we have to make sure that snow is removed from entranceways and things like that. But your occupier's liability, because you own that premises, would kick in. I think what's more important for some of us in recreation is the activity part. So what activity means is that it's not you who own the facility that's found negligent, but it might be the group who rented or used your facility that's at fault. So think about this. Think about the groups who use your facility. And if they don't have insurance, and if someone is injured, and if they're found to be either negligent or even partially negligent, and then if they're responsible or partially responsible, if they don't have insurance, that's a problem. So usually then what happens is the courts go back to the owner of the facility. If you have a group using your facility and they don't have insurance and something bad happens, they're going to go to you as the owner. So that's why you want to make sure that you have agreements with your group and possibly agreements that state that they have to have their own insurance. Like if you have a group holding an event in your facility and they're going to serve alcohol, usually you want to get a special type of liquor insurance just to cover that part, or you want to make sure the group has that. If the group doesn't have the insurance and they're found negligent, it's probably you as the owner that would end up paying. So knowing this, what do you think, what's one thing that you'll consider before letting others use your facility, programs, an activity, or an event? So I'll just pop that in there quickly. Let's just do a really quick round. So knowing what you now know about occupier's liability, what is one thing you have to consider before others use your facilities? Let's start with Justine, because I've done the same order the whole time. Justine, is there one thing that you might consider before you let other people use your facility?
Before using the facility, I believe, because of the containment orders and everything like that, and just being under that for 9 whole weeks and finally able to open up, I think I would put into consideration of proof of vaccination, just because other communities are doing that as well. And not only that, but I would like to make sure that the kids and elders and young adults and older people, I hope they are just really protected and just not vulnerable to this virus.
So you would require that rather than making your groups have that requirement, because you're the owner, you would make that requirement, which supersedes what individual groups would do.
Yeah, well, it really depends too, because our council here, basically they make some of the decisions for recreation, but they also take in suggestions and decide as a team of what would be best for the community.
Okay, thanks, Justine. Kelsey, is there one thing that I know RK doesn't have a lot of facilities, but let's say you're going to use somebody else's facility, what would you want them, thinking back to when you worked in Tesla, if you had a group using your facility, what is something that you would consider before they used it, as far as the legal risk?
Yeah, I would make sure that they were qualified, I guess, to run the program that they were running. So, like, if we were hosting a gymnastics camp in Teslin, I would make sure that the person who was actually running the camp had the proper certifications to run the camp safely.
Exactly. And you may take that a step further, right, and make sure that they're associated with an organization like Gymnastics UConn, who would also have insurance as well. Awesome. Thanks, Kelsey. Megan, I know it's so different when you're out on the land. So if you think of maybe, like, is there any way that you can answer this question, or what comes to mind when you think of sort of this occupier's liability from a land-based perspective?
Yeah, I was trying to think of something. We have a camp just outside of Aquatic, so I was thinking in this perspective, I guess, if they had any allergies. I noticed, like, birch bark allergies or, like, smoke allergies, people tend to have allergies to, like, the outdoors, so I guess considering that if they do have any allergies, they wouldn't be able to stay at our outdoor program or camp at our outdoor program.
Okay, so would that go in the agreement? Because so that's you running that outdoor space, right? If you had a group that wanted to rent that space from you. So that's a little different. So if you're running your own programs, that's going to come under the other ones. Premises means that you could be at fault. So if you don't check your cabins regularly and there's mold in one and somebody has a severe mold allergy and you don't have anything on site and they pass away or die, then yeah, maybe that's where that could come in. But another way of looking at it is if you have a group using your facilities.
Yeah, I wouldn't, this wouldn't fall under my organization then.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just the premises one would fall under yours, and that would be covered under your general liability insurance. So when you have people come on your premises, like in the camp, you have to make sure it's safe for people, right? And that there's no significant risk more than what you would expect from the type of activity.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. I know it's hard to wrap your head around all the different ones.
Yeah, I don't think... I'm sorry. I'm such a blob this morning. Thanks.
Please don't apologize, because as I said, I've been thinking about this for a long time and I still have to think through it. So, you know, and it's good to have this type of conversation because it makes us think a little bit more deeply about it. So thank you. Kim, how about for yourself, like, or from your perspective, is there something that you would need to consider before you let somebody else use your facility for their own programming?
Yeah, there are two things I would think about. The first was, I would want to see proof of that, of whatever, whoever the renter's insurance policy was, is that they had sufficient their personal liability coverage so that if something happened that I knew that it wasn't all going to be on me. And the second thing I would be thinking about was making sure that my own liability coverage included a clause for rentals so that I'm in fact covered to rent my facility or to loan the facility. But if I don't have that clause written into my insurance policy, there's a pretty good chance that the insurance company would not pay up for me.
Yeah, and then that might end up not being covered under your general liability and it might go back to personal liability, right?
You bet.
Yeah, that's great. Those are two really good examples of when other people are using your facility. So it's different if it's you with your own facility. Occupier's liability still covers that. If something happens, if there's injury because you were at fault, like the ice falling off the roof or mold or things that might cause serious allergies or things like that. So that's occupier's liability. So the last one here, the last example is product liability. And product liability described on slide 26 means that the manufacturer, the installer, or the owner could be liable if there's injury or damage that's caused by a defect. So in some cases, I mean, probably the biggest example would be like kids' toys, playground equipment, fitness equipment. If you sort of put those types of things in your mind when you're thinking of product liability. And so if you think that of a defect in how it was manufactured, then that product liability means that the person who made the equipment or built the equipment could be liable, and their insurance would have to pay. If the damage or injury was caused by you who owned or had purchased that equipment, or you changed that equipment, like you took a piece of playground equipment and changed how it worked without consulting the manufacturer, then you might be liable, and that would come under your organization's general liability insurance coverages. So I just have a really quick question, and then we're going to move on to talking about the activity. And my last question, and maybe we'll just answer this in about 10 seconds or less each. My last question is, as a recreation leader, what should you always do when you purchase, install, or repair equipment? What is one thing that you should do? Let's not put Justine on the spot again. I'm going to start with Kelsey. So, Kelsey, if you buy, install, or repair equipment, what's one thing you should do to make sure that you're not found liable if something bad happens?
Make sure that it's not damaged by the time that you receive it, like that it didn't get damaged coming in the mail or something, and is now not actually usable.
Exactly. And that's a really big thing for us in the North, so thank you for pointing that one out. Megan, what's something that you might do to make sure that you're not held responsible if there's an injury with equipment that you have bought, installed, or are repairing?
Yeah, I was going to say the exact same thing, like an initial inspection of the equipment, either rented or bought new.
Excellent. Tim, any thoughts about that one? What you would do with equipment when you purchase, install, or repair?
Yeah, using a certified agency to do the installation or repair, and making sure that that there are standards, that there are general public standards in place that would cover the piece of equipment installation, etc.
Awesome. So that's a really good point. I just put something similar. So you have to make sure that any adjustments or changes or things like that, or repairs are done with somebody who's certified to do that. So Tim's got snowmobiles in there. I'm thinking also of fitness equipment. That's a big one too. Justine, any other thoughts about what you might need to do when you buy, install, or repair equipment?
I was going to say the same thing of just doing the inspection and just making sure everything is there. Also with that, sometimes some companies do come with installation, sometimes the workers do forget that that the company does that, and so you just have to do a reminder.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, and also for bigger things, some things that are purchased down south, they may not work the same up north. So understanding what, you know, there's that part as well, right? Like, are you putting something where maybe it can't get cold? Like, just thinking, I think I saw a CDC post about the water in Iqaluit when the Army went with their treatment system. They've never tested them in cold temperatures before. So, you know, like, make sure that it works in the environment too. So, and then the last one would be, if you do make adjustments, make sure that they're in strict accordance with the specifications of your manufacturer. So those are the things that you can do to make sure as a recreation leader that you don't fall in under the, you know, something bad doesn't happen because of the product or equipment that you use. So we've covered a lot of information in a short amount of time. Meg and Tim just popped a message to you in the chat, and so I'll let you guys message back and forth while I move into the next section, and I'll give you some time at the end if you need to chat. So if you have any questions about liability, let's hold those for after the call recording, because I just would like to introduce your next required learning activity. So the next required learning activity is described briefly on slide 28, but in more detail in activity number 7. And just to give you a bit of background, this is a case study, and it encourages you to apply what you've learned about legal risk. And there's no right or wrong answers in this. It's taking what we've been talking about and learning and trying to apply it to a real life situation. So if you think that people engage in dangerous activities every day, they might scale steep cliffs or slide down the sides of mountains or go down white, you know, fast-flowing rivers. Really, in recreation and outdoor activities, the element of risk seems to make our activities much more attractive to a number of people. But sometimes, unfortunately, the risk becomes real and the results can be tragic. So generally, if someone is injured in recreation or sports, whether indoors or outdoors, the law doesn't necessarily hold people responsible because people understand that inherent risk with many of the activities that they're taking part in. So if somebody is injured, usually that injured person has to rely on private insurance and on the public healthcare system. That can be a really big burden on them. If somebody becomes paralyzed, for example, and has to use a wheelchair for the rest of their life, that can be a big, big challenge. So the RLA and the case study that I'm going to ask you to do, it involves a real case where an accident really happened and caused serious injury. And the person who was injured sued for damages, claiming negligence. So what you're going to do over the next week and a half, because the first part of this is due on Friday, November 19th, not just Friday, but the following Friday. So your job for the RLA is to determine, using a set of facts that you can find in activity number 7, whether there is negligence, and if there is negligence, how you would assign liability or responsibility. So right now, what we're going to do, I'd like you guys to think about, and I'm hoping to divide everybody up evenly, I'd like you to think about if you'd like to be a lawyer for the plaintiff, that's the person who's injured, or a lawyer for the defense. And then we'll split you up with those roles. So in over the next 9 days then, you prepare your cases. It's like a 1 or 2 page worksheet, most of which is blank. So there's 6 questions that you're going to take a look at to come up with your decision. So it shouldn't, I'm not asking you to do volumes of work or anything like that, but just to read through the case and answer a couple of questions and make a decision. Was there negligence? And if there was, who was responsible for it? So again, Activity 7 has all your case study instructions and the set of facts. So let's see. I've got 3 people in the chat. Justine, I don't see you in the chat right now. So I'm going to go around. You guys are in the chat. So pop in if you'd like to be the lawyer for the plaintiff or the lawyer for the defense. And Justine, over the phone, which one you'd like to be. So, Justine? Okay, we've got Megan down for the plaintiff. And Kelsey for the plaintiff. Okay, Tim, that puts you down for the defense. Justine, are you okay to do the defense?
Yes, I can.
Okay. And I see that Tegan was in there. Tegan, can you just pop into the chat if you want to be a lawyer for the plaintiff or a lawyer for the defense? And we'll just wait for Tegan to pop that in. And then Angela and Stacey weren't here, so I'm going to assign them each one of those. What do you guys think? Who should... Should I give Angela the plaintiff or the defense? Okay, I'll give her the same one as Megan and Kelsey. You don't have to work on this together. Okay, Tegan, I'll assign you to the defense then. So you don't need to work on this together. I used to do this activity where you would do it all together, but you're each going to do it individually. And then in week 3, if you go and look at week 3 in the learning event, there's activity 10 that says RLA making a case due Friday. So you follow the instructions and then you post your worksheet in here. So the worksheet is called You're the Jury, and it should link, let's see, yeah, there's a worksheet in activity 7, so if you're lawyers for the plaintiff, make sure you use that one, and if you're lawyers for the defense, make sure you use that one. So I'll put all this again just so that you're aware of it, and it's actually only a 1-page worksheet with 3 questions. So the questions are, if you're lawyers for the plaintiff, you have to argue there is negligence, right, because you want your person who was injured to get money, and you're going to say, why is there negligence, who is being sued, and who's liable for it. So 3 questions to answer. Let's just go around and see if you have any questions about that. So, Megan, any questions about the case study and how this will work as an activity?
No, I think I'm okay.
Hey, Tim, any questions?
No, it's all very straightforward. Thank you, Karen.
Awesome. And, Tegan, I see you've left the chat, but if you have any questions, just pop them in there. Justine, any questions about the case study? And the activity?
Not at the moment.
Okay. And Kelsey?
Hi.
Awesome. Okay. I'm glad I was feeling very, like it was very complicated when I was trying to write it all out. So hopefully it's pretty straightforward. So what we're going to do is it's really important that you guys post this. You can post it anytime between now and November 19th, but it's really important to have it on November 19th. Because then in our last week, what we're going to do is we're going to look at each other's sides, and on our fourth conference call, we're going to be the jury and we're going to judge, you know, was this a good call or not. So on our conference call on the last Wednesday of November, we'll work through that together. So for your required learning activities remaining in this RM103, I think most of you have done week one, the first one. So there isn't one for this week, but for week three is to complete your worksheet by Friday, November 19th. And then for week four, it's to join the conference call. And if you can't join the conference call on week four, please let me know because I'm going to ask you to do a different activity and share it with us so that then you will have done all the required learning activities for this learning event. And I just looked at my clock and it's 1 minute after the hour, so my apologies for keeping you 1 minute longer than planned. I wish you guys all the very best for the rest of the week. And Megan, I hope you can move from Monday to Tuesday and that things get a little smoother. And Justine, and enjoy the relaxed requirements in your community. So I'll end the conference call recording and I'll stay on the line. Megan and Tim, I don't know if you need to chat anymore, but feel free to. And I'll stay on the line in case anybody else has any questions. So thank you very much. Matichou, merci. Have a great afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks, Carolyn. And Megan.